afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We welcome you to the House Committee on Revenue for this St. Patrick's Day. Today we have public hearings on House Bill 2197 and House Bill 2089. I'm going to try and keep those in order without inverting them any more than I have already. So with that, I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2197. Mazin?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I don't know if it's appropriate to say the top of the afternoon to you. The Bill 2197 deals with the transient lodging tax, and it tries to...
Madam, we passed that last session. This must be a rerun of something wrong.
Yes, Mr. Chair, you're precisely correct. We did pass House Bill 2267 in the 2003 session. And what the 2267 did is levy 1% tax on transient lodging, and that 1% was on top and in addition to whichever grandfathered cities or local taxes, and the 1% was dedicated to promotion of tourism in Oregon. And it is to fund the Tourism Commission. However, it seems like an AG opinion to the Department of Revenue was that the language was not precise enough to allow the tax to be extended to vacation homes, condominiums, and some camp and parks.
Do you have a copy of that AG's opinion?
No, Mr. Chair, I don't.
I don't pay attention to him either, so go ahead.
But I believe that the Department of Revenue accordingly was not in collecting those taxes. So this bill is in order to sharpen, if you will, the language, in order to include that segments that was not included in the original language. Now, I have also included in your packet a few things about this issue. If you want to, the revenue impact statement that we could talk about, and in addition, also there are some amendments that were requested and came to us. The dash one, dash twos, and dash three. And let me say a few things about those just to clarify where we are with these. The amendments, the dash one exempts youth camps and church groups, if you will, from having this new definition extended to them. So, in other words, it includes them in the exemption that is on Section 3 on the second page of the bill, starting line 37. Now,
well, 37, if I read it correctly, it's the following are exempt from state transient lodging tax, and then the first item it lists are the hospital, health care facility, and assisted living facility. And if I'm looking at these amendments, they're trying to say that over again with some more specificity. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Greater detail, anyway.
Greater detail, okay. In order not to confuse some of them, I guess, with or wait for the interpretation.
Okay. Colleagues, before we bring forward the folks that wanted to testify on this, any immediate questions that you have? You've been given a brief explanation. Representative Comp is recognized.
The only question I have, Mazin and Chairman Butler, is with the amendments, there's different identifications with youth camp and church camp. Do all these fall under the definition of a nonprofit, or is there a reason we... Or are we going to keep coming back in another 2 years and look at this?
I think we'll probably hear testimony to that effect,
okay.
Representative. So your question is an excellent one, and I think it will be addressed as we hear from some of the folks
okay.
that come forward here.
Okay.
And that will, if it's not satisfactorily addressed to your satisfaction, Representative Comp, we will come back to that. So,
thanks so much.
You bet. Scott West and Todd Davidson are joined at the hip. You want to come up here, gentlemen? Oh, wait a minute. They're not. They're coming from the opposite direction.
We have the left and the right here.
Thanks for joining us today, gentlemen.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Todd Davidson, and I have the privilege of serving as the director of the Oregon Tourism Commission. I'm joined today by Scott West, who is the president and CEO of the Oregon Lodging Association. Mr. Chairman, at your pleasure, we are prepared to talk about some of the background on House Bill 2267 that was passed last session and some of the effects to date, or we can speak directly to the House bill that's before you today, House Bill 2197.
Todd, can you take between you and Scott 3 to 5 minutes and give us an update of what monies have been collected and how it's been utilized to enhance tourism and increase this valuable industry in the state of Oregon?
My pleasure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the passage of House Bill 2267 implemented a 1% statewide lodging tax that commenced on January 1 of 2004. The way the revenue is collected, we receive first revenue from the statewide lodging tax basically midway through the biennium. It was received by us in mid-June of 2004. So we've got about 6 to 8 months of those dollars. So it's not a full biennium. So we're currently looking at how we've been able to invest those dollars to date. What I think is important for the committee to know is that with the passage of the bill, the Tourism Commission immediately went to work meeting with the industry around the state. We held 9 meetings across the state with our industry partners. We had several hundred industry partners that met with us to discuss how they'd like to see these dollars invested. And with that input, we then drafted a plan for 2004-2005. We had anticipated and had testified before this committee during the 2003 session that we anticipated that this 1% statewide lodging tax would generate between $7 and $7.5 million a year. We are at $7.4 million. So we basically came in right about where we anticipated we would for this first year. The kinds of results that the Tourism Commission has seen with their programs, for those of you not familiar with the work of the Tourism Commission, I know many members of this committee are, but for those of you that are not, the Tourism Commission does quite a bit of research on their advertising and marketing programs. And the most recent advertising accountability research that we did told us that a $350,000 advertising campaign generated 220,000 new trips to the state of Oregon, where the visitors told us they would not have come had it not been for the state's advertising program. 84% of those trips were overnight trips, which is a number that we're extremely proud of because it is about generating economic activity in the state of Oregon. Basically, what this means is for every $1.69 the Tourism Commission invested in their media advertising programs, we generated a new trip to the state of Oregon, where the visitor told us they would not have come otherwise. That $350,000 advertising campaign generated $40 million in new visitor expenditures for the state. There are certainly other results that I could talk to you about today, but some of it somewhat anecdotally, because as I mentioned, we've only had the enhanced dollars for just a few months. But I can tell you that our fall advertising campaign is showing results like October inquiries up 65%, November inquiries up 100%, December inquiries up 90%. So the interest, the dollars are being put to work, and we're generating the kinds of results that we think the legislature and the industry would want to see.
Todd, regionally, do we know where that money is seems to be pouring in at this particular point?
Mr. Chairman, members of the...
Be sure to mention Eastern Oregon in your...
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate the extra tutoring. Let me be sure and point out that the dollars are coming in across the state as anticipated. There are seven tourism regions that we promote with, and there's a regional marketing organization in every one of those regions that we partner with in carrying out our marketing programs. On average, Portland metropolitan area is probably about 33% of all visitor expenditures in the state. The coast is approximately 18 to 20%. The valley is about 15%. Other regions of the state are between 7 and 10%.
Okay. Questions? Representative Riley is recognized.
You mentioned thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that there are inquiries pouring in. Do you know where those are coming from? Is there any breakdown of where those inquiries are coming from?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, there is a breakdown, and I can provide you those in greater detail. What I can tell you is the inquiries that are truly roaring through the door are those that are online. Our visitors are obviously moving more and more to the Internet, and what we're most encouraged by is they're moving beyond this concept of just looking to booking. They're starting to do things where they can actually book trips, make reservations, and those kinds of things. We're feeling more secure now in putting our credit card number online, and maybe we have Amazon and eBay to thank for that. But I can certainly provide you some additional detail on where those inquiries come from, but I will tell you that most of our advertising focuses on what we would first and foremost call the easy drive markets of Washington, Northern California, and marketing Oregon to Oregonians. We don't want Oregonians to think they have to leave the state to have a great vacation experience. Then we focus on Southern California, parts of the Southwest, including Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, and then the Western United States.
Quick follow-up.
Yes, Representative.
Do we do much advertising in Asian market at all, or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, great question, because my answer before was primarily focused on the domestic advertising program. Internationally, our focus is in Japan, in Asia. We don't do a tremendous amount of consumer advertising. It's prohibitively expensive. Instead, what we do is we tend to focus with travel agents and tour operators and have them develop tour products that they then put in their catalogs, and then they market on the retail side. So we work with the wholesalers, they work with the retailers, they get it out to the consumers. We find that to be a far more effective system for us. So not only Japan, but also in Europe, Germany, the German-speaking markets of Austria and Switzerland, and the United Kingdom. And then, of course, Mexico with the Mexicana flight coming into Portland is also becoming a much more appealing market for us as well.
Thank you. Scott, did you have a fight with Gillette? Is that what happened?
Mr. Chair, thank you for asking. The answer to that is no. But my wife would like me to get a little closer to the razor. I guess I just haven't gotten that close yet. Just, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Scott West of the Lodging Association, represent about 1,200 properties statewide. As those of you that were involved last session, we had a strong discussion over this issue. And as you might imagine, as an organization, as an industry that elected to offer up a tax on themselves, I just come here today to tell you that we've been very pleased with what we've seen over the last year. The dollars have come in as expected. It's here to say that the Tourism Commission continues to operate a very, very lean and a very productive organization. I will say one of the strong things that's happened that we sort of hypothecated, many of you in our discussions over the last couple of years, was that this would also be a strong organizational tool. It wasn't just a revenue stream for the state, but it was a strong organizational tool for the state's hospitality industry itself. And by creating these regional entities and by funding, moving money back out to the entities around these regional cooperative marketing programs, what we've seen for the first time in many years in the state was we had parochial factions that began talking to themselves and talking to each other on how to leverage both their local efforts, but also how to leverage a regional effort and then leveraging that with what the state's effort's doing. So it has been, in my opinion, a very strong start to that, and we have buy-in from all parts of the state. And Tourism Commission did a terrific job of getting the stakeholders involved very early on and getting them involved in how those dollars would be used and how we could best leverage these limited resources to really create more opportunity for the state of Oregon.
Scott, do either of you have any testimony relative to the Dash 1, Dash 2, or Dash 3 amendments that you want to take a look at today that we'll be looking at?
Go ahead, Scott.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've seen the Dash 1s, Dash 2s, and Dash 3s dealing. I think 1s and 3s are dealing with the youth camp or church camp circumstance on the nonprofit issue. Again, we believe that was covered last session, and in the interim had the discussions about drafting language to fix that. We believe the fix was in that. I can't remember what section it is in the bill, then number 5. I believe that the church camp folks and others represented believe that's a bit vague. We have no opposition to that amendment.
Okay. And final question relative to the tourism industry, because the two of you have really developed that to a fine and honed it to a fine talent. I had the pleasure of going leaf peeping this year in the Northeast to be amongst the millions of leaf peepers that come to the Northeast. And they've developed the tourism industry to a very fine art. How long do you think it'll take Oregon to get its tourism industry to the point where we really have that kind of, because that's an industry, it's got to be a number one industry for many of those cities, counties, and rural areas there.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's a great question. And the New England states have truly done a beautiful job, especially capitalizing on the fall foliage programs. And you raise a very, very, very valid point, and that's why one of the objectives of the commission has been to help mature our industry partners throughout the state. Many of them have never marketed internationally, and they need to understand what German visitors are looking for versus Asian visitors. So it's not only about advertising and marketing to bring more folks to Oregon. It's also making sure the industry grows in a wise way. And so we've made those kinds of investments. I believe with the passage of 2267, we've now accelerated that. I still think there's a tremendous amount of work to be done, but I think we're talking more a matter of a few years rather than, you know, decades where we might have before. Scott, I don't know. You have any other thoughts?
Mr. Chair, I certainly conclude with Todd's analogy. I think there's other niches that, you know, within the industry that will begin to mature, whether it's golf or birding, you know, birding down south and golf throughout the state. And that's just, those are just two. I mean, there is a the opportunities before us are fairly limitless. And I think that with again going back to the comments I made earlier, is that these regional approach and maturing in the regional arenas and taking a look at the type of product or the type of opportunities or assets they have there really gives it the opportunity again to regionalize it and also bring it back up through and using Todd's assistance in those arenas.
Mm-hmm. Further questions? Yes, Representative Oakwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to the percentages you threw out, or I guess the number of computer hits or whatever else you calculated in there. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, they're great percentages, but, of course, you know, a 100% increase of 1 is 2, and a 50% increase of 2 is 3. So, and I'm great. I love use statistics and campaigning, too. But can you give us some numbers here? What are we talking about when you say there's a 60, 100% increase and then another 100% increase? Are we talking 10,000 hits on the web page or 10,000 calls a month, 20,000, 30,000? Some sort of parameters, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, both people that called us in October were really excited about coming. because my mom got my dad to call, too. No, that's a tremendous question. The kinds of numbers we're talking about is that if you look at what I would refer to in staff meetings, like how many times do we touch the consumer? In other words, they either call us on our 800 number, we receive mail, email, they get to our website, whatever. We're talking a million a year. It was about 970,000 people last year. So we're talking some significant numbers when we see the kind of growth that we did in October, November, December.
So I'm assuming we're kind of at the front end of the dollars right now. We're going to see an expansion of that. At least you're envisioning a substantial expansion of those types of contacts as we expand the program.
That's Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, that's exactly right. We expect that, you know, we saw a fall campaign that we hadn't been able to have before we had this kind of infusion of dollars. So once we've got a full year's program, then we're going to start to see this mature even more. And we're going to continue to be as strategic as we have been, driving more people to the website. It's far more efficient for us to answer their questions online than to mail them a printed piece. Many people still want a book in their hands, but we're going to continue to drive more and more folks online and be as efficient as we can.
I just got to ask this question to make sure, but the people that are answering these inquiries back to them are from Oregon. They're not from India or some other place else, are they?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, yes.
They are from Oregon.
They are from Oregon.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Kamp is recognized.
Well, we have such an air of levity here today. I have to ask this question because if I don't, my students, I'm a middle school principal at French Prairie Middle School in Woodburn. On my last day, I asked the students, is there anything that I can do for you? And no, these are eighth graders. And they said, how can we get Six Flags to Oregon? So, and seriously, I've been asking that question and called Six Flags, and I haven't gotten very far. Maybe you can help out the students at Woodburn School District. But they said, you know, there's really nothing fun for us kids to do with our parents. Hmm. And that kind of struck a chord in me, and I thought, you know, out of the mouths of babes sometimes is something that's there for our future. So just planting seeds, not really a question, but if we could get Six Flags to bend or something. Hmm.
Thank you.
You certainly got James Sink's attention in the back. Thank you very
much. Thank you, Chairman.
Appreciate Thank it. You, Mr. Chairman.
The next folks that have signed up to testify on this bill, Patty O'Sullivan and Doug Barber.
Good afternoon, and I didn't plan this today, but for the record, my name is Patty O'Sullivan, and I'm here to testify on House Bill 2197 and to offer a friendly amendment. I work for the Department of Human Services. I'm the legislative director, and I've talked to Mr. Davidson about this. He seems amenable to this amendment. In the bill, in the exemptions, if you look in the exemptions, on page 2, line 38, it gives an exemption of a dwelling unit in a hospital, health care facility, and long-term care facility.
Patty, I take it that your amendment is dash 2?
Yes, sorry.
Please proceed.
And in order to stay clear with our federal counterparts, we would like to make sure that all of our facilities that are licensed or certified by the department are exempt. We understand that's the intent, but we just want to make sure that we never have any problems with an alcohol and drug group home looking perhaps like a vacation home when it's certainly not.
Has that been any problem in the past?
Well, Chair Butler, I'm not sure. It okay. hasn't up till this date, but as long as we're clarifying, we would like to have it clarified that all of our licensed and certified facilities are exempt from the bill.
Are there questions of Ms. O'Sullivan? I think the luck of the Irish is with you today. We're not working it, however. And so on behalf of the Department of Revenue, the dash 2 amendments are meet your approval.
Chair Butler, it's the Department of Human Services.
I beg your pardon? Department of
Revenue. And they do.
Yep. Thank you, DHS. Other questions of Ms. O'Sullivan? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Doug Barber?
Chair Butler, members of the committee, I'm Doug Barber, here today on behalf of the Girl Scouts. Our issue is our camps. We understand from proponents of the bill that the intent is to make our camps and other nonprofit camps, church camps, youth camps, exempt from this tax. That was not clear to us in the bill, in that list of exemptions, so we, working with Representative Berger, who has the Y Camp connection.
YM.
YM Camp connection. Had the dash 1 amendments drafted, talking with folks, proponents of the bill yesterday, they thought the language in that may be too broad, so I'm not sure who had the dash 3s drafted, but we're still trying to work out the final language to make sure. I don't think it's going to be that, I think we'll get there. The question is just making it clear so that the organizations like the Girl Scouts or Boy Scouts or some church group that has a camp can operate their camp and not get caught up in this tax.
Thank you very much, Doug. Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did ask for the dash 1 amendments, and there was a concern that it didn't preclude some church camp saying, well, we're a camp, we're exempt, but 9 months out of the year we're going to rent our facility to something that would be sort of profit-making and get in under the exemption. And that was not our intent. Our intent is that for the legitimate uses that a church or camp has, it isn't precluding adult programming at these camps, but to try and specify that if you come to a church camp operating under their mission, that you wouldn't have to pay this lodging tax. That's what we're trying to get to in the language, and The dash threes, actually, Maz and I had a discussion, and we're hoping that the dash threes get us there and don't cast too broad a net, but do make sure that these church camps, it's clearly not our desire to have them pay lodging taxes to people that go to church camps, youth camps.
Representative Berger, would you respond then to Mr. Barber's observations relative to the Dash 1 amendment?
I don't remember. Oh, which one?
The Dash 1 amendment, is it... it appears that the Dash 3 amendment limits what the Dash 1 amendment would have done.
Yes, exactly. That's the intent.
Okay, and so the intent is to limit what the Dash 1, so as to not the necessity of Dash 1 would no longer be there.
Exactly, and it's the language that was a little tricky in the Dash 1, which came to me might cause problems, was the line 2, a dwelling unit, a youth camp, or a church camp. That basically could be interpreted to say if you're in one,
you're exempt,
and it is possible that these camps could be rented like a, not for church or camp, but for some tourist use that really would be under the spirit of this tax. And we wanted to be sure that you know, that wasn't just a loophole that folks could get out of the spirit of the tax, but at the same time protect the youth camps, the church camps, who really are, they have dwelling units and they have people in them, but they are not what we want in this particular.
Doug, did you want to respond to
yesterday I spoke with Bill Perry from the Lodging Association, and he pointed out under Section 3, Sub 3, in the original bill.
Okay.
He thought that was what was getting at the camps, and part of what he was talking about in that was this 30-day provision. Because many camps, as I understand it, do rent their camp to groups that may not be the same organization. The Girl Scouts might rent their camp to another nonprofit to run a camp, or they might rent it to some other group for use on a weekend. And part of that is to defray the expenses of the camp and make it so it's affordable for the girls that they try to serve, and not to generate huge profits for some other purpose. And so what Bill Perry told me was that was their goal with that sub 3. We just didn't see it clearly enough for the camp to make the connection with the camp. So whether we try to combine that language with the dash 3s to make it clear that what's confusing, I think, to a lot of us is this members of the general public. In the Section 3 or in the Dash 3s, when it's not available for use by members of the general public, if that means that, right, you can't have your camp, people can't just drive up to your camp, knock on the door, and rent a room for the night. If that's what it means by general public, fine. If what it means is if your nonprofit calls the camp or even your company calls the camp and says, hey, could we rent it for the weekend for a retreat? Is that intended to be covered or not covered? My understanding was not covered unless you're doing that as a 9-month-a-year profit-making venture. So that's what we're just trying to get clarity on it, because we don't want to be back here next session revisiting you again.
So, Mr. Barber, with regard to the Dash 1 amendments that you have asked for, is it your opinion that the Dash 3 amendments now cover that?
I believe it does. I'd like to be able to run that by
folks
at the Girl Scouts to make sure. We just saw the Dash 3s a few minutes ago.
Thank you very much. Other questions of Mr. Barber? I'm going to ask Dexter Johnson to come forward, if you would. Dexter has assisted in a drafting of this bill. Thank you, Mr. Barber. We appreciate your participation here today. And Dexter, you've heard what we're struggling over, the Dash 1 versus the Dash 3, and the broadness or the narrowness.
Mr. Chair, members, good afternoon. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council Office. A couple of comments, I guess. The Dash The subsection 3 in the printed bill is designed to deal with the person who only occasionally rents their typically what they would live in or something, a second home or something like that. They only rent it for less than 30 days a year, even though it's transient lodging. The idea behind that was that it's administratively too difficult to have the tax apply to those individuals, and so they're exempt. Subsection 5, as originally drafted, was intended to include church camps and youth camps and any facilities like that where, in order to take advantage of the facility, you have to be a member of an organization. The Dash 1 amendments, my understanding is there was concern that that wasn't specific enough. The Dash 1 amendments were intended to expand that by stating that if you're a youth camp or a church camp, you're going to be exempt from the tax, whether or not, it doesn't matter how you use the property, you're going to be exempt from the tax. The Dash 3 amendments attempt to modify that a little by spelling out that those are examples of the kinds of facilities that are intended to be exempt, but again, putting in the requirement that it be only for when the dwelling units are not available to the general public, which I take to mean is you need to be a member of the particular organization that owns the facility.
So with the Dash 3 amendments, a Girl Scout camp, as Mr. Barber was concerned about, that they'd like to, and I've served on the staff of a Boy Scout camp at one point, you can open them up in the spring for a couple of weeks to debug them and get things working, make sure the water's all up and running and so forth. And then after you've finished your Boy Scout run in the end of the fall, mm-hmm. you'll have about 2 weeks to rent it out, to get the canoes put away and to get all the rest of it done. Under the Dash 3 amendments, those 2 weeks opening and 2 weeks closing, when you know before the snow melts off in the spring, before it flies in the fall, would be subject to the tax. Is that your understanding of it now,
Mr. Chair? No, only based on your facts that it's less than 30 days.
Less than 30 days.
Yeah. So that in that sense, the number
and the 30 days comes under line. Part 3.
Correct.
Okay. Of that subsection 3 of section 3.
Correct.
Okay. So to open it, to close it for rented 2 weeks before and rented 2 weeks after, then that's. But if it was rented for another 2 weeks during the middle of the winter, then all 6 weeks would be subject to tax.
All 6 weeks would, Mr. Chair. That's correct.
Okay. Representative Berger.
Raymond Dexter. Are we making an assumption that youth camps and church camps are only fit under the 30-day per year rule? Because there are church camps and youth camps that are open a lot more than that during the year.
To the public?
Well, that's the question. What's the public? If they are running, say, church programming and they're having folks come in from around the state that are members of their church to a church event in their camp.
Church camp.
Is it church camp? Mm-hmm. And if they do it all year round, where does it fit in here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I think if they do that all year round and it's limited to members of the church, that would be exempt under subsection 5, either in the printed bill or the Dash 1 or Dash 3 amendments.
I suppose you could limit the members of the church.
But I'm thinking, Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
If I might suggest, I think we need a little more work on and a little more information on what the scope of churches and camps are mm-hmm. under this heading so that we can sort of get there in terms of...
Representative Berger, I think that's an excellent suggestion, and I think that I'm going to have you appointed to do that as soon as we hear from Representatives Riley and Esquivel. Representative Riley is recognized.
Well, this may take care of what I was going to say, but typically in my experience, church camps are not run typically for the members of the church, but typically for members of the community, usually children of less advantaged families and so on, and not for members of the church at all.
I'm anxious about that too. What happens if the church does open it up for proselytizing at that particular point? If that's part of the mission of the church at that point, have they just violated the statute? Dexter.
Mr. Chair, I do want to point out one other thing that you should probably consider. That is in Section 5, Subsection 2. The Department of Revenue specifically has rulemaking authority under the bill to define a little bit more clearly what making use available to members of the public means. Because when we were sitting down and drafting this very issue came up, and there are no easy solutions to it.
Appreciate it. Representative Esquivel, did you want
to... Yes, I would like to. I'm almost afraid to say this, but does this work in conjunction with landlord-tenant issues when you're over a week? It's my understanding that then you come under the guise of landlord-tenant act.
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, actually, my recollection is that it's 30 days, and that's what the 30-day period of exemption in subsection 3 is
so
for.
So 30 days instead of 7 days?
Correct.
Okay.
Other questions? Colleagues, thank you very much, Dexter. I'm going to appoint Representative Berger as a committee of one to work with council and to work with the Boy Scout, Girl Scout, and the other eleemosynary organizations that would have an interest in seeing that this is done. We have heard testimony relative to the efficacy of the Dash 2 amendments. The question now is, can a Dash 4 amendment address this in a fashion that's going to overcome the concerns? With that, any further observations or questions relative to House Bill 2197?
Yes, sir.
Representative Hass.
It'll be nice to get back to something more less complicated like the disconnect issue.
Would you like him to be on the committee too, sir?
That sounded like a volunteer to me.
Yeah, man, this was easy.
A committee of two all of a sudden. With that, thank you very much for that observation. Colleagues, we'll close the public hearing on 2197 with an admonition to you, Representative, that within 7 days you will report back to us. We'll schedule this for 1 week from today, Thursday, if we can. And hopefully, if you maybe seek, I think there's two or three members that have had questions, and I do have some as well, personally.
Okay.
Colleagues, we'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 2089. Mazin?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2089 deals with a related subject, is in the arena of collection for the tax that we were talking about, that the current law stipulates that the agencies or local governments or state governments collecting the tax need to be sending whatever they collect as not specified, but they would send it any time. So if it's like $50 or $20, they would still send that. This bill allows that the local or state government or the state agency to hold on to the amounts of taxes until it reaches $100 before they would cut the check and send it to the Tourism Commission. In addition, I think that there are amendments that are being worked with Legislative Council at this time is to extend that allowance not only to state agencies but to others who collect the tax as well, just to make $100 before they met these amounts.
Thank you. Questions for staff? Doug Schultz, would you like to come forward, please? Aldersgate Conference Center.
Yes, Representative Butler, I don't know if there's a misunderstanding, but I was going to testify on 2197.
I've got you on 2089, but if you'd like to say some on 2197 that could add to that, let's see, we probably ought to open, let's do this.
Close this and open up another one.
Okay, you're signed up on 2089. Why don't we do this? Patrick, you're on 2089? Okay, I'm gonna temporarily close the public hearing on 2089 and reopen the public hearing on 2197. Doug, please.
Thank you, Chairman Butler and representatives. I'm Doug Schultz. I'm the executive director of Aldersgate Conference Center, just outside of town, and we are a nonprofit organization. But I'm here today on behalf of 37. Camps and conference centers that are members of the Christian Camp and Conference Center Association. And I've been in this industry for almost 30 years, so I have a lot of answers to some of the questions that you've asked today. Our concern is that this legislation still does not spell out exemption for nonprofit camps and conference centers. And the model of the youth camp that opens in the summertime for camping for the kids to come during vacation is a model that has evolved in a lot of ways. And many of our centers now operate on a year-round basis in order to stay open for those summer vacations and be able to help kids. And facilities have changed. Many of them are conference center facilities now. And in our own case, we are owned and operated by a constituency that we serve about 10% of our time, and we serve 11,000 campers a year, guests a year. And so we rent out the other 90% of our time to nonprofit and religious groups, to events. We do not rent out to people that drop in off the street. And I understand what that is, because on the other side, my wife and I own a vacation rental down on the Central Oregon coast, and so we understand transient taxes and the needs for those things. And but we don't do business that way at our camps and our conference centers. And my concern, I think all of our concern really kind of came out with the last gentleman here, where we're talking about 30-day limitations and things like that. Most of us don't rent to just our own constituencies and our own owning organizations because of the economic need to keep those facilities occupied so that they can continue to operate. However, there is something that you might want to consider tying this to, and that's our nonprofit status. The IRS has already said we cannot compete with tourist facilities. We can't rent to the person off the street. We can't solicit that kind of business. And even though our operations do contribute to the Oregon economy in the same way that other lodging does, yet we can't rent to the lodging off of people off of the street, the general public. And I also echo that concern that general public be defined in a way that clarifies what that is. And Representative Berger, I'd be happy to work with you and our constituency in answering some of those questions as you go forward in that.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Riley is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do I understand you to say that you only rent your facilities to other nonprofit groups? Is that correct?
That's right, and that's because we are a 501c3, and by IRS code, we cannot rent to any kind of a for-profit event like a convention center would, for example.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much, and Representative Berger, you have an ally here to help smith that out, it sounds like, and Doug's phone number is here on the sign-up schedule, too. So thank you very much,
thank
Doug.
You.
With that, we will again close the public hearing on 2197 and reopen the public hearing on 2089. We call forward Scott and Todd once again. Scott West, Todd Davidson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Scott West, Oregon Lodging Association, once again just here in support of House Bill 2089. It was mentioned earlier that there is an amendment coming, and I believe that the amendment addresses the fact that if there are indeed lodging entities in any sector that are only collecting that amount of money, whether they're public or they're private, it seems to us from an administrative point of view, it just makes sense to have that same courtesy extended to whether it's a small B&B or a small vacation home that may generate small amounts of money and just will assist with regard to their efforts to comply. And so that was, I believe that's the intent of the amendment, and we support both the bill itself and the amendment, the conceptual amendment that we believe is covered.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Todd Davidson with the Oregon Tourism Commission. And I just signed up in anticipation that there may be a question about whether or not waiting until there's $100 to remit would in any way affect us as an agency who's the recipient of those dollars to then invest. And I just want you to know that we actually think this bill is about efficiency. It makes perfect sense to us, and we're supportive of the bill and the conceptual amendments that are being proposed at this time.
So if I understand correctly, Todd, if it took 3 years to generate $100, they could wait 3 years to submit it.
I may be mistaken, Mr. Chairman, but I believe there may have been a clause or part of the conceptual amendment that's being discussed is that there would be a check written at least once a year.
Once a year.
So that if there was a if it took a year to collect $100, that's fine. But at some point, the books need to close, because if this also affects local lodging taxes, I believe city and county governments, and I certainly will not pretend to speak on their behalf here today, but I certainly believe they would probably want to, at least on a fiscally annual basis, be able to close those books.
Yeah, we don't have the amendment here today, and just taking the bill by the four corners and reading it, looks like to me that you could wait for 3 years. I mean, I'm going to plead guilty, send the IRS and the Department of Revenue my way. I think folks have paid us, for 2 weeks this past year for coming and using the place that we've got. So, but that's less than 30 days. But mm-hmm. at some point, it might certainly get over the 30 days of the year. Mm-hmm. But number one, we haven't collected any tax. Number two, if we do, I'd certainly like to see it to go on beyond that, but administratively, if you get people off the books for more than a year, that's a problem. So, but we don't have the amendment.
No, Mr. Chair, the amendment, because I think the amendment deals with private entities with the whole tax collection for the transient tax, that is going to touch a lot more than this clause of the law. So the amendment might be even lengthier than the bill would be in this case.
This just had its last hearing. Okay. Rep. Sainberger.
Mr. Chair, I think this gives you a flavor of why it took us so long last session to get this to the floor.
I think there were three people here that were on the floor when that bill went through the House last time.
Only three.
Only three.
Yeah.
And I think there were two that voted yes and one that voted no. So. Representative Riley.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. Scott, I really like the way you've decided to do your sartorial, and I wanted to know how you chose the color.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, I thank my father and mother for that.
Scott looked a lot younger before he started to tint his hair this color.
Yeah.
I noticed that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it was just last session.
Yeah.
This bill. Thank you very much, gentlemen. We have a couple of other folks signed up here. Janet Tindall, Gil Riddell, and Patrick Allen are all signed up.
It's been a long day. It's getting better.
Janet?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Janet Tyndall. I'm the Assistant Director of Administration for the State Parks and Recreation Department, and I'm here to ask your support of the bill as originally drafted, and let me explain a little bit about why I think perhaps the amendments to this bill are not appropriate. The statute that we're amending here is within the Parks and Recreation umbrella statutes, and it was specifically, my understanding, written that to allow the state of Oregon, when they collect or when they have campers, to collect lodging taxes and transmit those to local governments. Normally, governments don't tax other government agencies, and so this was specifically to our department. I think perhaps maybe your other bill to add some more complexity would be a better vehicle for including those private sector.
So you're opposed to attempting to try and amend this?
I would recommend that, yes.
Okay. Thank you. Questions of Ms. Tyndall? Thank you, Jana. And then next is Gil Riddell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. Addressing the original bill, we conferred with State Parks over the interim and had some productive, informal, intergovernmental discussions and support this original concept. I'm glad you noticed, though, that there isn't a backstop of 1 year, and hope that will be taken care of. In terms of the amendments, of course, they're in drafting, so we haven't seen them. But I understand the equity involved of applying this across the board. The one thing that gives me pause, though, is even with a threshold as low as $100, $100 times X, an unknown, could have some budgetary significance. I just don't know that. And it may be helpful for the committee to have that. And maybe the committee could consider, if they want to go that direction, a smaller threshold, say $50 or something, before payment is made over. Because it's, if memory serves, it costs, I think for the parks, I think it costs about $20 to process one of these payments. And it costs local government probably an equal amount to process them too. So it makes perfect sense to eliminate, to reduce the paperwork. Makes absolutely good sense. Mm-hmm. I just, at this point, I don't know what the impact would be with the amendment. So that's just a note of caution.
Thank you very much, Shrewdell. Appreciate it. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Patrick Allen with the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. We're a co-requester on the original bill, and I basically just wanted to make a brief comment in support of the philosophy behind the discussed amendments. I can't speak technically to them or to the issue that Parks raises, but certainly the notion of applying that kind of a processing efficiency to private payers is consistent with all the approaches we've been taking in terms of regulatory streamlining, and would whether applied to this bill or applied to the other bill would make them more would make the application of that system more streamlined and would be a good thing.
Questions of either Mr. Riddell or Mr. Allen? Did you have something more you wanted to say,
Mr. Chair? If I could address one more issue.
You bet, certainly.
Janet Tyndall, Department of Parks and Recreation. I would assure everybody that the reason that we have these small dollar amounts is when we get to the end of our camping season, we have, you know, two, three, maybe six visitors. We don't accumulate a lot of tax. As soon as we roll into the next camping season, it immediately bumps up, and so the one-year limitation, even as the bill is written, would not be a problem because it's going to be more like 3 to 6 months, if
okay.
that.
Thank you very much. Other questions of these folks? Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here. I guess, and I'm going to ask either Scott or Todd to, when they have the amendments, to make an appointment. And I am not going to reschedule this bill until we've had an opportunity to take a look at that, even though there are some supporters for this. But I'm anxious. I'm anxious that we don't do anything to destroy the work that was hashed out and turned Scott's hair very gray last year. So, with that, colleagues, yes, Representative Lizio.
One question, and this is in the spirit of, we had the U.S. Poet Laureate at the session today. Line 13, remit the tax collected at the next following reporting period. The next following? isn't that redundant? Or that needs to be in there for reasons that I do not comprehend?
Representative Galizio, I'm going to assign you to go down to Legislative Council and get that opinion. Thank you very much for bringing that to our attention, and you will report that back in 3 weeks when we hear this bill again.
That's two. Did you notice I haven't raised my hand today?
With that, colleagues, thank you, Representative Galizio. With that, colleagues, we'll close the public hearing on 2089, and we'll close House Revenue.
End up on a word.